let's get started and push through a little bit. We have this afternoon the civil commitment bill, which the governor's representatives are here to speak on the commitment criteria. And I want to do that first. We also have a long list of bills and another meeting in this room beginning at 6 p.m. We are going to push through. I wish the witnesses on the public hearing bills would take into consideration the fact that we're going to be pushing for time, and there is a floor session at 4 p.m. which we are, our request to the Speaker of the House is that we be excused from the floor session. Those kinds of requests are not necessarily always honored, so beginning at 4 o'clock we may be in and out of this room. With that, I will open the work session on House Bill 2324 for the purposes of hearing from Corey Streisinger and Janice Yaden. Yes, Janice. And by the way, we are having still in the process of getting the amendments on this bill, which committee members, you will remember that we've worked through over a couple of sessions, and we should have those. When we have those available, we will probably interrupt the public hearings that we're on to come back to 2324. With that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey Streisinger, I'm the governor's legal counsel, and I'm here to speak to the Dash 12 amendments, which contain expanded criteria for civil commitment. I appeared, as you know, before this subcommittee several weeks ago to discuss these expanded criteria as well. What brought me here was a pair of attorney general's opinions that suggested that expanded criteria would, in fact, or at least could, violate the Constitution, that it was an open question, but one that was a serious question. And at that point, after doing a preliminary review of those materials, Governor Goldschmidt's position was that perhaps it was not the best idea to go ahead. After that point, the governor did go over the legal materials in some more detail and also met again with some of the families involved here. And as you may be aware, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the governor does have a very deep personal commitment to these families and to the problems that they suffer. And his conclusion, after speaking to them again, and after again reviewing the legal materials, is that if there is any way to go ahead with these expanded criteria, he would like to do it. He realizes, I think we all realize, that we have no guarantee that these criteria will withstand a court challenge. It's simply an open question. The Supreme Court hasn't ruled on it. There are lower court decisions, but there is no definitive word. And Governor Goldschmidt would like to, on behalf of the state of Oregon, see if we can be out there in front and perhaps be a test case, but in any case, see if we can do what we can for these families to help them with the serious problems that they're having with people who are not committable under the present criteria. Now, once we had gotten to that stage, we started thinking about, first of all, how can we prevent expanded criteria from being misused? It's very clear that the one thing none of us want is to have expanded criteria in place that will permit circuit court judges, when faced with family situations that generate a lot of sympathy, to be able to use these expanded criteria as more or less of a dumping ground for people who shouldn't, in fact, be committed at all. In addition, that would run a risk, an even greater risk, of a court challenge, because if the criteria are used improperly, we'll be in court immediately and our test case will be a poor one. So what we asked the Attorney General's office to do, and Mr. Young is here in case you want to go into any details, is to redraft the expanded criteria to make sure that they only address that limited population group that we know about and have previously identified as appropriate for commitment. And that is the group of people who have been institutionalized before repeatedly, who are classified as chronically mentally ill, and who are exhibiting symptoms of rapid deterioration into a mental state where they would be committable under existing criteria. So we added to these criteria a requirement that the Mental Health Division review and certify the objective portions of the criteria. In other words, that the person is chronically mentally ill and that they have been previously committed. So that will preclude circuit court judges from using the criteria to simply commit people out there who are exhibiting strange behavior. The Mental Health Division will ensure that it's the target population that we're dealing with. So, on behalf of Governor Goldschmidt, I'm here to urge you to adopt the Dash 12 amendments, which do expand the criteria for civil commitment. Both Janice and I would be glad to answer any questions the committee might have.
Questions? Corey, you said the Supreme Court. Which one?
The U.S. Supreme Court. This is a federal constitutional issue. The state constitution, interestingly enough, does not have a due process clause of that has, and these issues really wouldn't come up under the state constitution.
Spirit of Hans Lindy just entered the room briefly.
Okay, no questions.
This I had him in mind.
This is present in the bill. The proposed language is not there, and the Dash 12 amendments would embody what the governor now proposes.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And this, let me ask it this way, this is a bit different direction than this committee had from the chief executive about 3 weeks ago. Would that be a fair statement?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Further comments or questions? Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on 2324 and open it on Senate Bill 421.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bell.
Before we close the work session, could we have counsel tell us now what each one of the amendments, whose amendments are on 2324-2, since we're up to 15?
Why don't we say that till we take the time to go back into work session and
are
just
we
do,
do that? Today?
Yeah. But we have a lot of bills up for public hearing, and we're waiting on some additional amendments, and we'll do that when we do have those additional amendments. My intent to finish dealing with 2324 today. Senate Bill 4.
Can we get that in writing?
It's on tape. The work session on 2324 is closed, and I'll open. Let council switch seats and open the public hearing on 421, and let council fill us in.
Senate Bill 421 makes the dollar amount limits that are applicable to garnishment also apply for collection procedures used by state to collect public assistance repayment in certain circumstances.
I'm sorry, Council. We have signed up Ira Zara.
Mr. Chair, Ira Zara from Oregon Legal Services. The people who are supposed to testify on this bill, Jim Young, who's the director of our Coos Bay office, car broke down somewhere between here and Salem. I would like to tell you basically what the bill does and what the need is. I don't have written testimony. It will be submitted later. Basically, the problem is that when the state, when there's a child arrearages, child support arrearages, that amount of money can be garnished, that the person who owes that can be garnished at up to 50 to 65% of their income if they're in arrears on their child support payment. And we have no objection to that, and that's the federal law, and that's the way things probably should be. If someone's on AFDC, that person assigns their support to the state, and a state debt is created. If the individual owes the money, who's been garnished at 50 to 55%, goes back with their family, and there's still an outstanding state debt, at the current time, they garnish that person's wages at the 50 to 65% rate. In other words, the people have reconciled, they're back together, The state debt is the only debt that's owed. Child support is being paid. No one's behind in child support in any way. And they're still being having up to 50% of their money's garnished. All this bill does is say that the state cannot garnish for state debt at that amount. They can garnish at 25%, the same as any other creditor, and they will get their money back in due time with that sort of procedure. It will help families stay together. It will not put the economic difficulties that a family would have by losing half their income for what is essentially a state debt. This came about because the need for this bill came about just historically. We had several clients in that situation. We brought it to the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. They said, can you get this done by rule? We submitted a rulemaking procedure to the SED. They said, we won't do it by rule. And we've come back to the legislature. I will say that the amendment that you have in front of you is from the Attorney General's office. They are in support. SED has no trouble with this amendment either.
Well, we'd like to have it before us.
Well, it's not the amendment. It's the Aiden Gross version. Oh. It's basically the result of the AG's amendment. And that's the, in a nutshell, what's going on.
Any questions? We'll move into any additional witnesses on this one. Please come forward. Ira, why don't you stay right there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lawrence Young, the Attorney General's office. I drafted the version of the language that you currently have in front of you in the A engrossed bill. I concur with what Mr. Zaroff said, but I would like to correct one impression that he might have left with the committee. When a public assistance grant is closed and current support is no longer required to be paid, it is true that a wage withholding or wage garnishment continues upon a person. The amount that is actually withheld is based upon state law, and the amount that is normally withheld under RS 25310 is the greater of either 25% or the amount of the current support order plus a dollar. Now, what happens on people who have high income and low support orders, the maximum amount that's withheld is 25%, the same as what's happening with this bill. The only place that people are really affected is if they have low income and high support orders, and this would correct an inequity and protect them. But it is not DHR or DOJ policy to go out and squeeze people beyond the limits of what is permitted by state law.
So I take that as an official position in favor of the bill?
That is correct.
Thank you. I'll close the... anybody else to testify? Close the public hearing and open the work session. Representative
Chairman,
Dix.
I would move Senate Bill 421, E engrossed, is that correct? To the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dix moves the bill to full with a due pass. And I'll place that motion. Is there further discussion? Debbie, we call the roll.
Bellman?
Aye.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Dix?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Hammond?
Aye. Motion is adopted. Representative Dick, will you carry that to full committee?
Absolutely. Some trouble now.
We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 471. And I have signed up Ira Zaroff again, Zaroff, and we ask that Senator Cullen be called. I think she wants to testify on this one and the following one. But Ira, why don't you go ahead while we're waiting for the senator?
For the record, my name is Ira Zaroff. I work for Oregon Legal Services. I'm representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, testifying in support of 471. Let me give you the testimony here. This bill does is it seeks to make certain that when there's instances of spousal abuse that those that spousal abuse is considered relevant to the issue of custody of the children. There is a letter accompanying my testimony which chronicles a couple of cases in Marion County where there's been severe spousal abuse and the judges refuse to hear that evidence. This occurs in several other counties in Oregon, many counties that is not a problem in. Judges routinely do hear that kind of evidence, but courts throughout the state are split on this issue. There's a great deal of documentation that spousal abuse is relevant to children, and that children who are raised in abusive homes are affected badly by that kind of abuse. That people who are raised in violent homes and in abusive homes tend to be abusive themselves, that they tend to be involved more in crime than children in other homes. There's evidence that people who are abusers continue to repeat that sort of abuse in other relationships, and that therefore just the mere leaving of that relationship does not mean that it will not be continue to be a relevant consideration. The children, as I said, children who are raised in those violent homes continue to exhibit patterns of violence themselves, that it's a problem essentially of the state making it clear that that kind of domestic violence does have an effect on children. One of the things that the statute does is it says specifically that evidence of spousal abuse shall be considered detrimental to the best interest of the child. And I'd like to explain why we think that's necessary. Basically, there's additional testimony which I have here from a woman who is Melody Dabney, who's a child specialist in Eugene. And she talks about two different kinds of cases that she's been involved in. Cases where she, as an expert, has testified about spousal abuse, has testified about the effects of that spousal abuse on the child, and been a participant in the court proceeding. And those proceedings, the client, the abused person, has gotten custody of the child. In other proceedings where there's spousal abuse of the same nature, but no representation, or the issue of spousal abuse is not raised, what happens in those is that the person does not get custody, it is not considered as detrimental to the best interest of the child, and you have a completely different result in two cases where you have precisely the same factual setting, or virtually the same factual setting. And the only reason for that is that one person is not able to hire an expert and the other person is. Under this statute, the judges will consider spousal abuse as detrimental. The statute is not meant to say that if there's spousal abuse, the issue of custody is totally foreclosed. That's not the thrust of the statute. We believe that under this statute, a judge could still decide, even if there is spousal abuse, that the other parent is not a fit parent, is not able to care for that child well, and can still balance the criteria for custody and rule against a person who's actually been abused. But we do think that it should be considered detrimental to the best interest of the child. So, I have actually some additional testimony, more and more. This is testimony from Tina Frost, which I'll hand in, and testimony from the Women's Rights Coalition also. Vote all in favor.
We have Rhonda Parent to testify next. I'm sorry. Were you finished?
I am finished. I'd like to stay after witness.
Well, the other thing is, are there questions of Ira?
Question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Miller.
You said the courts are split on whether or not they can receive this evidence now. In current law, and I guess it's going to be renumbered sub 3. Do you have a copy of the bill?
Yeah. Actually, I don't. I'll get it. I'm familiar with it.
There you go.
Which reads, in determining custody of the minor child, the court shall consider the conduct and some other things
of either party only if it is shown that any of these factors are causing or may cause emotional or physical damage to the child. Is that the section that is talked about and is found to be insufficient by some?
We think that section is insufficient for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's a great deal of clinical evidence that spousal abuse is detrimental to children's best interest, and that judges are not hearing it. They're refusing to hear it. They're not hearing it at all. They don't even get to the threshold of allowing it into the hearing process. And essentially, this is a presumption that it's detrimental.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
I guess why, given that statute exists or that portion of it exists, why can't you get that evidence in?
I believe it's just the judges who have decided that it's not a relevant consideration. I can't speak for them. I just know that it happens throughout the state. I would think that you could also. I just know that you can't. In Marion County specifically, a number of judges will not let it in regardless of the circumstance.
Further question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
If, Ira, in your opinion, in the current law, if we struck on line 18 the word only, would that cure the problem?
I don't believe it would. I believe that there's a prejudice against allowing that information in.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We bring Rhonda forward.
Mr. Chair, are there witnesses signed up opposed to the bill today?
No. Senator Cohen does want to come in and testify.
My name is Rhonda Parent, in support of Bill Number 471. Let me start by saying that children are affected by what they witness. Parents, courts, etc., cannot begin to feel the pain a child suffers, a pain that is etched in their minds forever. They will never forget, nor can they. I come here today to hopefully enlighten you as to how a child is affected by spousal abuse. I have been emotionally and mentally abused by my parents. This was not intentional on their part, but due to being forced to live with them and then witnessing spousal abuse, it has damaged my ability to understand and enjoy simple joys of affection, communication that the average person takes for granted as part of a loving relationship. To summarize the effects, only giving two examples, I wish to share with you the following problems I face because of the spousal abuse which I have witnessed.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dix, we have all the time in the world, so take your time.
The lack of affection that I received from my parents has resulted in making me uncomfortable in receiving and giving affection. I tend to reject the affection and giving of others, for I've never known that to be a normal part of a person's life. In order to mentally survive in the household I lived in, I had to emotionally withdraw myself. The only person I could count on was myself. It has reached a point where giving love or receiving love in particular felt so unnatural that the emotions of love seemed strange and overwhelming. Because of never knowing how to cope with these emotions, it's easier to reject them than to accept and deal with them. The way in which my father treated my mother, I was never shown a reason to have faith in other human beings. It has made it difficult for me to build lasting friendships and relationships because I am quick to withdraw from an individual as untrustworthy after the slightest failure. When you consider this bill for passing, consider the children. Give them a peace of mind. Let them be free of witnessing abuse. Please let the abuse be heard. Only Allah can protect them from unnecessary damage, which they will carry with them for the rest of their lives.
Thank you. You know how difficult it was for you to come up here and talk to us.
It's very difficult. It took me 4.5 hours to write that last night.
Thank you. I'm going to move on. We want to... Ira, do you want to stay up here and tell us about the other bill, too? Well, we're seeing if Senator Cohen is coming. Close the public hearing on 471 and open it on 472.
Ira Zarov, representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. This bill does three things. It amends the Abuse Prevention Act. The first way that it amends it is it allows district attorneys who enforce Abuse Prevention Act orders, which are obtained ex parte, that is, without a hearing, to get attorney's fees for that enforcement. And what that means, if there's an Abuse Prevention Act order served on the abuser then violates that act by committing a further act of violence or in some way violating its terms. At the present time, the district attorney can't get attorney's fees for that. They can only get attorney's fees if there has been a hearing. That was an oversight last session. This fixes that. The second thing it does is it changes the venue for where an Abuse Prevention Act or thing can be filed, petition can be filed. Currently, it can only be filed where the abuse occurred or where the respondent lives. What that means is that our petitioner, someone who's abused, who flees the county, cannot file that in the county in which they go. There's been instances of problems where a petitioner went to file in a particular county where the abuse had occurred, the abuser was waiting for them at the courthouse, and they were further abused, as were in fact abuse prevention workers who were safe house workers who were also in that circumstance. This changes the venue and makes it the same as domestic relations, which essentially the petitioner could file where they were residing also. The third thing it does is it expands the Abuse Prevention Act to make people who haven't lived together in the last couple of years, but who have children together covered by that act. And those people have continuing contacts, they have continuing contacts over children, they're often volatile and sometimes violent confrontations, and this would allow the act to protect those people as well as people who are married and have children together not living. So that's what this act does. I'll submit my testimony to you.
Anyone signed up against this bill?
I'm looking. We have no one else signed up on the bill. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak on the bill?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bellamy.
I am sure that Senator Cohen wouldn't mind if we went into work session on these two bills without her testimony.
Debbie, have you gotten any? Is she on her way?
We'll go ahead and just work on them. She won't care.
Let's go to work. Well, I'll open the work session on 471.
Mr. Chair.
What is the... yes, Representative Bellamy.
I would move Senate Bill 471 to the full committee. Do pass recommendation.
And I'll place that motion. Further discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Miller.
I'm still interested in removing one word, even in keeping the additional language, but in removing the word only on line 18 in the bill as printed. I think those other factors are relevant, and indeed if they cause emotional or physical damage to the child, then they ought to be considered.
Mr. Chair. Representative Dix.
I would support the motion of Representative Miller as a co-sponsor on the bill. And striking the word only.
A second. And knowing full well that that will place this in a conference committee rather than the passage of in the House being the final act. We're getting down to the end of this session.
I,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Miller.
Just to react to that, I think it's a concept that probably could be understood by the senators and probably dealt with rather quickly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bauman.
I'd like to speak to these, just having practiced with this statute, and speak to the importance of keeping the word only in there. And I think it comes down to a consideration which in my sort of simplistic universe has always been big little, and particularly consideration that I've used not only as an attorney in evaluating cases, but as a parent in refereeing between those kinds of disputes the parents get to referee, big and little. I think that there are some kinds of conduct, there are some kinds of marital status, there's some kinds of income status, there's some kinds of social environments, and there's certainly some kinds of lifestyles which are subject to bias, which do not cause and which do not have the potential of causing emotional or physical damage to the child, which do not become, on their own turf, so to speak, issues in custody battles, because